Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here with yet another episode of the Thriving Farmer Podcast. And today my guest is Bryce Lowen of Blossom Bluff Orchards in the heart of California's Central Valley, where they cultivate organic stone fruits and persimmons. Since 1931, the Lowen family has been committed to ensuring each fruit is picked at peak ripeness for unparalleled flavor and quality. Bryce, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Give us a little bit of a background on your kind of journey in agriculture.
Well, my personal journey is interesting. I'm part of kind of a legacy farm here. My great-grandparents on my mother's side purchased the original 30-acre parcel that we've grown now to approximately 78 acres over the generations. But I grew up here on the farm for the first part of my youth. I was not super invested in the farm. It was grandpa's farm. So I grew up here with my folks. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a teacher. And I played on the farm. I worked on the farm. But we weren't directly invested in it until I got a little older. My dad decided to leave his law practice and pick up the work here at the farm when I was in my early teens, in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's when I became, my sister and I, and both my parents, became much more dedicated and invested in what's going on here. I actually, even through that span of time, was pursuing a different vocation. I went to school for animation, so I got a Yeah, I've got a degree in computer animation that I have yet to use, I have been able to apply some of what I learned there. I developed our logo, and I take care of any of the graphic stuff that we use to advertise or whatever. So got a little bit of benefit from that, I'm fully committed to the farm life as of, about 10 years ago. So,
okay. Now, for your dad to go from lawyer to farmer, what was that draw? Was it just the change to a better working environment, or was there something specific that set that off?
Yeah, my dad's a super intelligent guy, and he's, a very good lawyer. I think for him, the satisfaction, the job satisfaction wasn't what he was hoping for. He did get to do a lot of good things for a lot of people, but
yes,
it's a very, very high stress job and a lot of work hours and a lot of time away from the family. And ultimately, when my grandpa was getting a little older and none of his kids were stepping up to, take over the farm, and it was looking like it was going to have to be sold or leased. My dad saw the opportunity and decided to go for it. So it was a pretty bold thing to do. I mean, he had some. He grew up in the Midwest. He's actually from Kansas. So I mean, he grew up around large ag, corn, and that sort of thing. And he did a decent amount of work in that field, just as help. Tree fruit farming is a whole different thing, especially here in California. So he kind of just jumped in with both feet and, he made it work. He's a smart dude, luckily. So
Yeah. All right. So let's break down tree farming in the Central Valley, because that's a little bit of a unique. You said there's a lot of trees there, though, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say, by far the dominant type of agriculture here is nut farming, almonds specifically. But there's an awful lot of stone fruit, like we're doing, peaches, plums, nectarines, etc. There's quite a bit of citrus as well. We also do some citrus here, just a few acres worth. Pomegranates. Yeah, I'd say probably tree fruit farm or tree farming, nut and fruit is what probably dominates the Central Valley for the most part.
So what's the life cycle on that? Like from planting, how long to production, how long are the orchards viable?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because the reality is that the viability of the trees, in our experience and opinion, is quite a bit longer than what the industry standard suggests. It really depends on how you're treating the trees and how you're farming. For production purposes, stone fruit, you figure, you know, you put the trees in, they're about a year old when you plant them. You probably have at least 3 years before you can get any kind of even minimal production off of them. Citrus is even longer. I think 5 to 6 years is more realistic. They grow a little slower. So in general, I mean, you need to plan ahead. You need to be thinking, you know, sometimes years and even decades into the future when you're planning out what you're going to do. For that reason, you know, we try to get as much lifespan and production out of our trees as we can. We do a decent amount of grafting as opposed to taking out trees and replanting. If the trees seem viable enough that they're going to produce for a good, you know, 10 years. Then rather than take them out, well, one of the challenges with tree fruit farming in organic is when you take the trees out, you want to fallow for at least 3 years. So that adds another chunk of time before you plan to get back into production. In the conventional world, you'd fumigate, and we don't want to do that. We couldn't do that, and we wouldn't want to anyways because we're trying to keep our soil nice and happy and alive. But you do want to give those soil-borne pathogens time to die off. So that's kind of the only alternative. Our approach is we'll take out, if trees are getting tired, if they're starting to really look like they're not producing, we'll take out smaller blocks and fallow and then replant 3 years later.
So that 3 year, is that normal for everybody, or if they're conventional, do they just fumigate and then immediately replant?
Yeah, conventional farmers fumigate and replant, and so they're back up in production a lot faster.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you guys, so in that 3 year rotation, what are you typically doing? Is it going to a pasture crop or just other short term crop?
You know, I've for a long time had plans to do something with that ground, and we really don't have a existing plan. We basically just let it go to weed, and we'll maintain it by mowing just to keep it under control and keep it from being a fire hazard once things dry out. But for the most part, we're letting the soil do what it's going to do, and we'll feed it back its own green manure, but we don't really do any cover cropping on those blocks or anything at the time. We do, though, I should say, get some pretty nice, just natural flowering wildflower type of stuff, and so it's feeding beneficials. It's certainly providing some benefit, but it's a very passive type of benefit. So
yeah. So then the crop is starting to produce after a certain number of years. What is kind of like the yield per acre on typically some of these stone fruits? Is it like a tons per acre?
Yeah, tons per acre, and that varies a pretty significant amount depending on the type of fruit we're growing, peaches and plums, nectarines, apricots, citrus. It also depends a lot on conditions year to year. One of our strategies, I call it a strategy, but it's kind of a, it could be seen in multiple ways. We grow a lot of different varieties. We have about 100 different kinds of stone fruit that we're growing on a relatively small acreage, about 55 acres of what we have here is stone fruit. So in a lot of cases, it's literally a single row of a specific type of fruit. And part of why we do that is, the reason we planted so many different varieties or grafted so many varieties to begin with is we wanted to have a diversity of options available throughout the season to bring out to the farmers market and or sell to our accounts. They like to see a lot of different things on the weekly menu. With stone fruit or summer fruit, if you want it to be really excellent, you're really working with a pretty narrow time frame per variety. You can get away with harvesting early and storing things, but if you want peak flavor, you're better off, you know, getting them as tree ripe as possible, which means they're not going to last as long once you pick them. It's kind of, yeah, it's a blessing and a curse in a lot of ways. Year to year, depending on conditions, things can kind of jump around in the order. But we end up having a lot of different stuff. And one of the benefits of that is if something, like for instance, last year we had a very wet spring. That ended up, in our case, doing a pretty decent amount of damage to some of the blossoming fruits during bloom time. And in some cases, some certain varieties were super weak. Like we didn't have a crop of, the early apricot or whatever. The benefit to having a lot of different things, though, is hopefully something else is available in that slot that we can kind of shift over to. All that to say, it's really in our case specifically, it's really hard to keep track of or to predict year to year what kind of yields we're going to get. I think for stone fruit, tonnages, gosh, you know, honestly, I'd have to look at my records to give you a good a good number.
What's the most productive though? I'm assuming peaches are probably more productive than apricots.
Generally, yes, okay. That's right. And there too, it depends on the timing. Peak season peaches are quite a bit more productive than early season or late season, depending on conditions. Late season peaches are excellent, but they are more susceptible to fungal issues that might arise during the season. Early season peaches just don't get as big because they haven't had the time on the tree. Correct. That mid and late season do. So peak season, and that, you know, around here we consider kind of late June through early August. That's kind of when we get the most production on the peach front. Apricots can be real sporadic year to year. Different varieties behave differently, but actually, we have Apriums, which are an apricot plum hybrid, and those tend to be the more consistent, and they come a little later than typical apricots, so they get bigger, and they're also they seem to be more consistently set than our early season varieties.
Gotcha. So then, talk to us a little bit about the challenges of growing that fruit organically.
Well, you know, I think it's a fairly common set of issues. I found it in stone fruit production. Our main organic challenge is fungus. Here in the Central Valley, we tend to have very dry conditions in the spring, which is again a blessing and a curse. We'd like to get a little more rain wintertime, early spring. If it ends up happening kind of mid-bloom, then we see more fungal issues in both the bloom time and later on when the fruit's actually set and is growing. Brown rot's a big challenge. Mm-hmm. Peach leaf curl is a challenge. As far as organic options for dealing with those things, I found that they're a little more tough to battle than pest issues or, you know, nutrient issues, obviously. I think in those situations, we really don't have too many problems with pests or nutrition. But fungus can be a bit of a challenge.
Gotcha. And I'm assuming there's just a short list of sprays that you can use for that then that are certified organic.
That's right. Yeah. Our main organic fungicide that we use as Serenade.
Uh-huh.
Historically, we've used sulfur, wettable, you know, sulfur. And for peach leaf curl, we use copper still. But yeah, we're limited.
Yeah. Okay. And then share a little bit about what does the season look like for you guys? Like when are you pruning? When are you harvesting? What does your sales season look like too?
Yeah. So, well, because of the way we've structured things here, the summer fruit season is our big, you know, that's when it's go time. That's the bulk of what we're growing here. So our very earliest varieties start coming off typically, we've had them as early as late April, but typically early May is when we start to get our very first plums, peaches, and apricots. And then they kind of ramp up, and peak season, as I was saying before, is kind of, actually, I'd say mid-June through July. August, we still are in production, but we're starting to taper off a bit. We do have very late season peaches that come all the way into September. And then beyond that, we do a number of different fall fruits, like the persimmons you mentioned. We have pomegranates. And we recently, about 5 years ago, planted a couple acres of kiwi that are just starting to produce consistently for us. So we're doing that in the fall as well. And all through winter, and actually even currently, we're harvesting citrus.
Okay.
Right now we're on our last mandarin of the season, the golden nugget, and I've got probably, I think we've got another couple weeks worth of harvesting to do on the golden nugget. So, in a real ideal situation, we've got something fresh year round. It just varies considerably, you know, the quantity of what we're,
yeah,
what we're producing.
Tell me about the kiwi fruit vines, because we're actually working with some hardy kiwi fruit here, and I think that's the biggest thing that's making me scared is just the intense need for these massive trellises.
Yeah, well, you know, we're this is a learning process for us as well. The kiwi is something that we just planted 5 years ago, and it's the first orchard crop that we've had on the farm in my lifetime. Before my time, we had some table grapes that my grandfather had here at the farm. So I'm learning about vines as well. We ended up investing in a pretty heavy duty structure because of those concerns. In fact, ours incorporates a shade cloth that's retractable that we use for shading the vines. Central Valley conditions are pretty, during the summer, are, you know, we're pretty intense here.
Yeah.
We get very high temperatures sun's pretty intense. Our cold in the winter is not nearly as frosty as I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with, but having a little protection for the vines was something that was recommended when we planted them, so we went ahead and did that. So far, you know, the structure seems to be holding up nicely, but we're only 5 years in, so we'll see how things continue. The vines are getting fairly hardy, but they're going to grow quite a bit more, so we'll see.
Yes. Yeah. So then did you go with some big giant wood trellis or like a steel or aluminum structure?
We did steel. Yeah. And in fact, we did some search. Wood's kind of not even, if it's going to be a new structure, would not be allowed under CCOF guidelines because you'd need to use treated lumber.
Yeah.
So steel seemed to be kind of our only option. So that was not cheap, but, the good news is I think it's going to, you know, last quite a while. Hopefully, you know, 30 plus years. We'll see. So,
yeah, out here we intend to do locust because it's naturally rot resistant, but I'm assuming you probably don't have access to that in California.
Not that I'm aware of. That's interesting. Sure would be nice to have something like that.
Yeah. But I would say it is very tough to find it here in the Midwest even too, at least in sizable aspects, but it's by far preferred just because of, I mean, it'll be there 60, 70 years later. So.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello, dear listeners. As the green shoots of spring emerge, signaling planting season in full swing, isn't it the perfect time to bring new life onto the land? At shop.growingfarmers.com, a treasure trove awaits to transform even the most forgotten corner of your space into a vibrant oasis. Imagine lush elderberries and willows swaying in the breeze, or the sweet promise of homegrown strawberries and the hearty depth of rhubarb pie made from your harvest. Perhaps you've pondered over the joy of harvesting your own potatoes. Well, ponder no more. Our small business is dedicated to bringing you an exceptional variety of plant material to make these dreams a reality. We're shipping daily, ensuring that your planting ambitions are supported with timely and quality deliveries right to your doorstep. So if you've been eyeing that sunny spot by the fence, or considering how to fill that quiet corner of your yard, look no further. Our perennial selections are not just plants. They're future harvests, memories, and the beginning of a more sustainable lifestyle right from your own land. Visit shopgrowingfarmers.com today and make the first step towards a greener, more fruitful farmstead or garden. We can't wait to grow with you.
Talk a little bit about your marketing. Let's kind of dive into that a little bit. So you're at farmers markets. Is that the main source of your sales?
We are at farmers markets. And that was kind of, I'd say that's kind of where we planted our flag once my folks got involved with the farm. But before my parents were involved, this was a very kind of traditional small farm. It was a pretty common thing to see around here up until they got into it in the 80s. Families would have a 30 or 50 acre block, and they would pick the fruit and send it into a packing house, and then they would, it would get distributed. We actually have always, my grandfather always packed here on site, so we have always had a packing shed where we did our own packing, but turning it over to the wholesalers and then, mm-hmm. Letting the chips fall where they may was pretty safe and viable for a long time. When my folks were getting involved, that's when big concerns were starting to become challenging, and where that model was becoming more and more sketchy, less consistent.
Yeah.
So we started going to farmers markets primarily in the Bay Area and selling direct. At the same time, we were still selling into the wholesale system and finding, not a whole lot of windfall there. We would do better at the farmers markets, so we focused more and more on that direct sale approach. As we moved along, we expanded into delivery routes to restaurants. The chefs would come through the farmers markets and find us, and they'd pick up a bunch of fruit and. Eventually it just made more sense to get orders from them and deliver directly. That way we could maintain our supply at the farmer's market for the customers and also service their needs. Mm-hmm. That grew into, multiple day deliveries and into finding larger customers like, independent grocers. So that's basically, the model as of, probably 10 years plus ago, we've been explicitly selling into, or direct selling, I should say, either to stores, restaurants, farmers markets. There are some, we have a couple of accounts that are essentially, they're wholesale, but we're selling to them at the same rate that we would sell directly to stores. So it doesn't feel like wholesale, it feels like, we're getting more bang for our buck.
So
it means that we have to do a lot of running around, and we do our own deliveries and all that. We do our own orders, and my sister and I are basically on a weekly basis calling around or emailing and getting orders and filling those orders. Mm-hmm. So wearing a lot of different hats, but ultimately it's to the benefit of the farm to make those direct connections. So.
Correct. Yeah. So then with your wholesale, are you selling to any other farms that may be like doing CSA or anything like that? Or is it more to just the grocery store type?
Yeah, we do some, we do some cross-pollination with other farms that are doing CSAs. We actually had our own fruit CSA for a little bit, a number of years ago. It was tied to another farm, but, we would set up boxes of, seven different kinds of fruit each week that would go out to different people. I love working with other farms if we can. So the CSA model is interesting. It's you know, it's kind of feels like it's had a lot of ups and downs, and it continues to evolve. But there's one supplier right now that's buying quite a bit of our citrus that operates. They operate as both a wholesaler and a CSA. So yeah, I mean, we're kind of hunting for anyone that wants our fruit. We're trying to get it to them.
So you also sell some dried fruit. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've been doing dried fruits here historically forever. You know, for a long time it was just kind of for personal, you know, gifting and whatever. When my grandpa was doing it here, it's turned into certainly a viable piece of our economic model. We sell a pretty significant amount of bulk dried fruit to grocery stores that either repackage it themselves or put in their bulk bins to sell. We also do our own packaged dried fruit that we sell at the farmers markets, or we sell for resale. We sell them online as well at our website, blossombluff.com. We try to make the most out of what we're growing here, and oftentimes the best fruit is too ripe for transport, so it ends up getting cut, and we sun dry our summer fruit. We do that on raisin trays, wooden slats out in front of our packing shed. And then we process it and sell it in small bags or in bulk. We also dehydrate our persimmons. We slice them thin and dehydrate them, and some of our citrus as well. It's just another way to value add to what we're doing here. It's always been a challenge. My dad, to this day, my dad has a hard, and me, we have a hard time throwing things out, you know, and...
Yeah.
Especially fruit, you know, because the fruit's so great. If we can find another use for it, we'll do it.
Gotcha. So then with that, I'm assuming you take that to your winter farmers markets, or that allows you to have something at the farmers markets, a dried product, all year round.
That's correct. Yeah. We don't typically, during the summer, we have so much fresh that's available. We don't usually take up any stall space with the dry fruit display.
Oh, okay.
But during the winter and the fall, it's great to have a little something extra, a little more color on the stand, and summer fruit. You know, people, even in its dry form, summer fruit is pretty hard to beat. So it's nice to have that as an option for our customers as well.
Yeah, because I'm looking at your Facebook page here, and you guys offer the amount of varieties. You just said 100 varieties. And there's some varieties here I've never seen, like these really small plums, I think, the green plums.
Yeah, is that the Persian green, or is it there's a number of different ones we do. Emerald Beauty.
Yeah.
The first plum of the season we get is called the Persian green, or goji sabs. And it looks like a cherry, kind of. It's about the size of a large cherry. They're more of a savory plum. I really like them. They actually taste like a Granny Smith apple. They have a kind of a tart, crisp.
Really?
And they're traditionally, it's a Middle Eastern fruit. There's something that up in the Bay Area, the Persian community, and you know, folks that are from that part of the world originally, or their families from that part of the world, they get really excited when we have those because that's something that's kind of a street food there. They'll buy them in paper cones and then dip them in salt to eat them. It's one of those oddball things that we found at the nursery, you know, these trees, and we thought, let's give that a shot. And we were picking them ripe, which is not the way to do it. They're supposed to be picked a little green, a little tart. And so we had to be corrected by our clientele. But once we figured it out, they've become quite popular. So,
gotcha. Very cool. So, talk a little bit about like how California agriculture is changing, and what does that mean for your farm?
Well, I think that at least I try to be optimistic here, and it seems to me that I'm seeing more and more organic production occurring in the Central Valley. There's always been a big organic push on the coast and in the north of California. Central Valley is very very conventional for the most part. Mm. But that trend seems to be changing. In fact, one of our neighbors here that grows walnuts about 5 years ago decided to switch over to organic farming, and that's great. And especially having someone bordering us that's also organic feels mm-hmm. nice. In general, I mean, and there's all different motivations for that. You know, certainly there's some large big players that are going organic, and they may not have the same motivation exactly as we do, but the way I feel about it is, you know, people are using more regenerative practices and are doing a better job of taking care of our soil and our environment. I don't really care if they're doing it for profit or not. You know, I want to see more of that happening here, and I'd like to, mm-hmm. you know, encourage that. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then you also have bees on property too, correct?
We do. Yeah. That's kind of what started off as kind of a side hobby of mine, about 7 years ago. And, it's really become beneficial, especially with the kiwi. It's always nice to have bees around. Especially with our, pluots and some of our plums, the bees really do a lot to help with pollination. The kiwi, they're crucial. Like you need them for that. So I've been keeping bees here for about 7 years, and I recently started a little side business for my sons. They're called the Bluff Brothers, and they're selling.
Okay.
Yeah. So if we harvest any honey, I typically keep the bees for pollination, but we do borrow some honey now and then, and we'll sell that at the farmer's market under the Bluff Brothers label, and people have been pretty excited about that. It's really, really good honey. So.
And I also noticed that you call it, is it something centric here?
Oh, apicentric.
Apicentric. Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a term that basically means that the health and the natural lifestyle of the bee is what is most important. I'm keeping the bees in top bar hives, which are essentially, it's an empty trough with slats laid across the top. So the bees, as opposed to a Langstroth hive, which is very, you know, formal frames and foundation,
yes.
These are more like what they mimic a hollow tree, you know, what you would find in nature. You're still able to manipulate the comb and get in there and inspect and do all the things that are required, you know. But the bees are essentially given autonomy, and they're able to build out their comb the way that they want to do it. I think that's ultimately better for bee health. It creates essentially a more natural environment that that the bees would be more inclined to settle into.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you talked about this being your sons, and your sons are really involved in this. I'm looking at the pages here with them doing the chickens and the bees. Talk about that and the importance of having them be the next generation to you.
Yeah, you know, we're keeping chickens here in the yard. You know, it's not really officially a part of the farm.
Yeah.
The bees are out there benefiting the farm for sure. You know, I grew up here on the farm, raising my two boys here on the farm, and getting a sense of connection to agriculture is really important to me and to our family. I've said all along, my parents were very good about not pushing me into doing this, and I want to be the same way with my boys. I want them to pursue whatever is going to be the most fulfilling for them. At the same time, I'd really like to, you know, give them a taste of what we do here and feel like they have the opportunity, if they want to continue this legacy. And I don't know. Yeah, like I said before, you know, I didn't grow up planning to be a farmer. My parents didn't eat. My dad didn't either. These are all things that kind of fell upon us, and they weren't thrust upon us. They were available.
Yeah.
And so I really grew to appreciate the farm as I got older and had spent some time away from the farm. It wasn't until then that I really appreciated what was available here and what a special opportunity it is. So I want to do the same thing for them. And equally, though, don't want to make them feel like this is what they're going to do if they don't want to.
Correct. Yeah. You want to give them that out, that option. It's really interesting because I interviewed, I believe it's Paul from Full Belly Farm.
Oh, yeah. I know Paul.
Yeah. And he was talking about how his kids, a fair amount of them, left the farm and then came back because they also didn't realize just what they had going for them there. I think that is when you get out to the craziness of the world, it may be feel like exciting and fun, but then you realize that there's just something about being on the land that's so different and can be so calming.
I think that's true. Yeah. Different strokes for different folks. But for me, that definitely was the case.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the same thing with our kids, is we want them to know that's always there and available. And if they want to come back, we'll figure out an enterprise to help them make their livelihood off the farm. So,
nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do a little bit of value adding too. I want to talk about, you've got these, persimmon, little sets, like this rack that you make with a branch and all of that. Talk a little bit about that, because that's super unique.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. That's it's called hoshigaki, and that's it's a traditional Japanese drying technique that's very meditative. We actually used to we made an attempt at making them ourselves here to sell. And found that it was, you know, as great as it is, it's just so much labor. instead we decided the way to go was to, you know, give people the tools to do it themselves and, you know, let them have that experience. It kind of grew out of a, there was a chef, about 10 years ago that we've had a long time relationship with that was asking us to harvest the Hachia persimmons in a certain way so that he could hang them and dry them. Basically what you're doing is you're peeling hard Hachia persimmons and hanging them up to dry just in the environment, like not using a dehydrator or anything, just in the environment and maybe with a fan, you know, to keep the air moving. And then periodically over the course of several weeks, you go in and massage the fruit you soften it up with your fingers and then you let it dry again. And it continues to slowly dry over a couple weeks. And as it dries, it creates a rind on the flesh and ultimately a bloom of sugar that completely covers the fruit. And it's a really, you know, neat process. It takes a lot of effort, but at the end of the day, you've got this really special, you know, very labor intensive dried fruit product. We started off by just harvesting Hachia persimmons with the stem. We call it a T-stem. We leave a little T-shaped stem so that you can suspend those with string. And then I decided a couple of years ago, hey, why not create a whole kit, you know, and we started picking or cutting persimmon branches and hanging the string from them ourselves and packaging them with the persimmons in a box with some Excelsior, you know, and making it look pretty. And now we sell those during the season. We can only do that seasonally, like when the hachias are ripe. So we do that in the fall, and they've been pretty popular. People seem to like it, so.
That's very cool. What advice would you give to someone who's just thinking of starting a farm?
Oh, boy. Think hard about it and, get yourself a plan because it is it's a lot of work. It's potentially very expensive. if you are, especially if you're trying to purchase property. I think leasing property is probably, you know, the smart way to go to start with. And if you're going to do that, think about what you want to grow and think in terms of the length of that lease. If you're doing annual crops, you know, certainly you don't need to worry as much about getting a 10-year lease or whatever. But if you're going to do any improvements on the site or plant anything that is perennial, you certainly want to make sure you lock in your time there so that you're not just putting something down that's going to get either taken away or, you know, have to be removed in a few short years. I would recommend if you don't have experience in farming, get some first, you know, work on a farm, learn about it, hands-on, you know, reading about stuff and going watching videos is great, but you really got to get your hands dirty, I think, before you understand, you know, the reality of what's going to be required to make it successful. I guess that's kind of the primary thing I would recommend.
Okay, very cool. Well, Bryce, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your expertise and about your farm. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.